From receiving medical care to coping with anxiety, how to best care for oneself in the time of coronavirus. For many people, these are really stressful times. For example, for people with mental health diagnoses, cancer patients, people with serious dental problems, women with complicated pregnancies, the list goes on. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Even those of us with no usual medical concerns may be finding ourselves coping with high levels of stress and anxiety right now. Today on Maine Calling, we will spend the first hour examining the medical repercussions of the coronavirus crisis. In the second hour, we will focus on confronting anxiety. An important note, Maine Public Radio will cut away for the daily Maine CDC news conference at 2. Our second hour, focusing on anxiety, will immediately follow the news conference. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we continue to address how the people of Maine are dealing with the coronavirus crisis. First, we'll talk about how non-coronavirus healthcare is being addressed during this time. Then, Maine Public will broadcast the Maine CDC's live briefing with CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah and Governor Janet Mills. Following that briefing, we will continue with our second segment of Maine Calling about coping with anxiety and stress during these uncertain times. Please stay with us for these important programs. Joining me now for our first hour to talk about healthcare issues, Dr. Steve Stout, who is Medical Director of Ambulatory Services for Maine Behavioral Healthcare, and Dr. John Alexander, Chief Medical Officer with Central Maine Healthcare. As always, this show is for you and the audience. Do you have questions about trying to see a doctor or a dentist or receive mental health treatment? Are you wondering whether people can still visit someone in the hospital? Any question, email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Stout, Dr. Alexander, thank you so much for joining us. I know so many people have questions. And Dr. Alexander, I'm going to start with you. Many hospitals have curtailed elective surgeries, but many people still need health care, from people who are going to give birth to cancer patients. What are hospitals doing right now? How are they treating what we would call regular or usual patients?
Well, Jennifer, thank you for asking me to join the call again today. And you're absolutely right. We have so many patients, so many Mainers who still require health care. One of the topics we've discussed in the past has been the fact that we have an aging state. And so because we have an aging state and a large number of our population are either elderly or soon to become elderly and have chronic medical conditions, we still need to attend to their needs as well. What we've done and what other health systems across the state have done is to really use the information that we have about who our patients are, what diseases they have, what their prescriptions are, and in a coordinated fashion work with our providers and with our patients to identify what can be postponed, again, not canceled, but postponed, what needs to be rescheduled, and what can be done over the phone. So as an example, most of our primary care providers within the Central Maine healthcare system, and again, I say this speaking, having had conversations with other healthcare leaders around the state, we've taken to looking at which patients we can contact by phone, ask them how they're doing, determine if there are prescriptions that need to be refilled, and make sure that those prescriptions continue to be refilled. Sometimes just as simple as asking a patient who, many of our patients are, you know, very well educated in their own health conditions and understand they need to check their blood sugars or check their blood pressure. They can tell us how their blood pressure is doing or what their blood sugars are, and we can work with them while they're still safe in their homes to make sure they're getting the care that they need.
And if someone has an appointment coming up, what is the best way to determine whether or not that person needs to keep their appointment? Or is the advice changing day by day?
Well, the advice does change, has changed an awful lot day by day, although I think we've gotten to something of a new normal in terms of routine visits. As we've taken the approach, and again, the other health systems around the state have as well, that we've been proactively looking at our appointment schedules at least several days, if not a week in advance, and proactively reaching out to our patients. Certainly, you know, if you're at home and you're trying to make the decision about whether to have to go to your appointment and you haven't heard from your provider, then absolutely you should, you know, please feel free to contact them. We've been doing everything we can to keep our lines open so that we can be responsive to our patients' needs. But like I said, we've been trying to really be proactive about reaching out to those patients or their family members and discussing with them the strategy that we'd like to deploy. That's true for visits, and that's true for procedures as well.
Dr. Steve Stout with Maine Behavioral Health Care. I want to bring you into the conversation. You know, Dr. Alexander talked about postponing visits. I know for many mental health patients, postponing visits isn't really a very good option. What is being done? What are some of the main concerns when it comes to mental health treatment?
Jennifer, thanks very much for allowing me to be on the program today. And you're absolutely right. It is very difficult for somebody that already is experiencing anxiety or depression to have an appointment postponed. And at this point, we are still continuing to see our patients as we have previously been in terms of their schedules, and we're continuing to see new patients. We are, as Dr. Alexander pointed out, we are also attempting to change our appointments as much as we can to telephone appointments, and hopefully in the next few days also to televideo appointments, so that we will decrease the risk associated with those appointments. But we understand that we have an obligation to our community to provide as much behavioral health care as we possibly can under these very difficult circumstances.
So what's being done? Are our therapists, our psychologists still seeing their patients face-to-face in some cases?
Well, in some limited cases, last week we went from a place in which we were seeing virtually all of our patients face-to-face to one in which we began seeing about 85% of our patients by telephone. We are working as hard as we can to get to a place, hopefully sometime this week, where we're able to see people by televideo, which will certainly be a more helpful, friendly format, and will also help with that last 15% of patients that we have not been able to see remotely. We will hopefully be able to see a larger proportion of them remotely as well.
Well, let's talk about the role of technology in sort of this new world we're all living. I'm hosting this program from my home. I know many people work in organizations where very, very quickly IT professionals have rolled out technology solutions to the challenges that we're facing right now. Dr. Alexander, is that happening in the hospitals as well? Are there people connecting for telehealth solutions that were not before this week?
That absolutely is happening, Jennifer, in a number of different ways. You know, for starters, the transition to the electronic medical record, you know, several years ago really afforded us the opportunity to be able to, you know, complete documentation, review test results, and really, you know, now communicate with our patients in a remote fashion. So we're using that functionality more and more, as Dr. Stout mentioned, more and more week by week. A lot of the platforms that we're using, however, still continue to be relatively traditional in terms of telehealth, which is literally the telephone. So our providers and some of our nursing staff and others, support staff, you know, are able to access information electronically by the computer and then reach out to patients in many cases simply through the telephone. We have started deploying use of some additional technology even in the hospital, which will allow us to be able to communicate with patients who may be in an isolation space because either they are awaiting the test results of COVID-19 or if they develop a positive COVID-19 test. And that's not to say that we're not going to provide hands-on care for those patients. We absolutely are. But one of the things that we're learning and we're recognizing is that there are many things that we can do safely behind a screen or behind a window that can be done. And then we can save the interactions for those patients when we need to make sure that they understand that we're there. You know, as a physician, I still am a big believer that that the touch, the power of touch is very powerful. And so we still are providing compassionate care to our patients as best as we can.
Sure. Are hospitals reconfiguring their sort of their physical way of operating so that people who do have a COVID-19 diagnosis will be physically separated from others?
We started that last week, and we have been going through that process. So, and we do that for a couple of reasons. One is that it makes just more sense given how quickly the information is changing and even the different requirements for use of personal protective equipment is changing to be able to focus on a smaller workforce, almost a specialized workforce. It also helps us to help to preserve and conserve the equipment that we need. That's the personal protective equipment, that's supplies such as hand sanitizer, that is some of the medical equipment that we need. So we started plans to convert one of our wings at Central Maine Medical Center into a space that has all isolation rooms. That allows our staff to be focused on those patients who are in that area. And we'll be doing the same thing with our emergency departments, and we'll continue to look at other areas around our healthcare facilities, both in hospitals and even ambulatory sites, to make sure that we have a way to have the team members who are assigned to those areas focused on the specific needs of those patients.
Dr. Stout, what additional challenges are there if someone with serious mental illness ends up testing positive for COVID-19? How does that complicate matters, and how do you respond?
That's a good question. At this point, we are really rapidly moving towards a televideo approach, and we hope to be able to help folks that have serious mental illness through a televideo platform. There will be instances in which we will have to come up with another remedy. And as Dr. Alexander was describing, we are also actively constructing a plan to consider how to take care of those folks in a separate place from people that do not have COVID.
We're talking with Dr. Steve Stout from Maine Behavioral Healthcare and Dr. John Alexander of Central Maine Healthcare about the healthcare repercussions of the coronavirus crisis. We are looking for your questions. Call us at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now is Jenna Maynard, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Thanks for calling in, Jenna.
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad to be here.
Jenna, I understand there have been more calls to 211 than usual. What kind of calls? What are people most concerned about, and what are they experiencing?
Well, I think there's a whole host of concerns, from accessing care to accessing medication to what about paying for co-pays if they've been laid off. So I think the situation like the COVID virus is really raising people's anxiety. And as we're talking about the population of people with serious and persistent mental illness, we also have to keep in mind the co-occurrence with significant health issues, higher rates of obesity, higher rates of physical health challenges, which makes them even more vulnerable in that high-risk population for needing hospitalization should they be exposed to the virus. And there are many of them. We operate one of the state's care centers, and so that those folks are aware of their elevated risk, and so they're struggling with both their ongoing mental health challenges and then the fact that they know that they're in the group that is most likely to be significantly impacted should they be exposed to the virus.
What is NAMI doing to help people who may need extra help during this time?
Well, I think NAMI and a lot of our partner agencies, from the Autism Society or Maine Parent Federation or, you know, any of those other entities, as well as the statewide network of peer centers, are providing virtual support groups, are providing virtual groups like Alternatives to Suicide or RAP or those kinds of opportunities using Zoom. We definitely as an agency have used Zoom for a long time, and Zoom is something that's being really widespread used within the peer community, as well as Facebook Live conversations. And so I think that there is, if someone is hearing this program and they're thinking, I need support, but I can't go anywhere, they can call NAMI Means Helpline. We can connect them to their closest peer center if they're not aware of where that would be, because that network of state-funded peer centers that do exist to serve people significantly impacted by mental illness are absolutely taking their services virtual so that folks can feel connected.
All right, and tell us what that helpline is.
622-5767.
622-5767. We'll also put that information on the Maine Calling Facebook page and website. And Jenna, before we let you go, are you confident you have enough people working those lines to handle this increased pressures?
Well, I think it's not, you know, NAMI Maine is doing our part, but really the community-based mental health system is stepping up, whether it's peer centers or providers, trying to engage in whatever ways we can creatively come up with. And so I think that there is a lot of support out there, and folks who are feeling isolated need to recognize there's still a lot of ways to get support and should reach out, and we will all be there as a net to find the right resource for them.
Well, Jenna Maynard, thank you so much for calling in and being a part of this program. Jenna is the executive director of NAMI Maine. Dr. Stout, I want to ask you, has the reasons for or the bar for which somebody might who's having a mental health crisis might call 911 changed in these times and called for an ambulance?
I'm not sure that the bar has changed for being able to call 911. Certainly we would like to be able to offer other alternatives rather than using 911, given how stressed our emergency system is currently and will likely to be over the coming weeks. And so making use of a phone number such as what Jenna just gave us before one got to the place of needing 911 would be great. Using the help that one gets through one's primary care office would also be a great alternative. We are working hard to try to establish closer ties with our primary care colleagues during this time so that patients that may have mental health needs that they may not have previously had will be able to get help through their primary care providers and with our assistance. But we would certainly want everyone that feels like they need additional help to have some path to turn to.
Dr. Alexander, if somebody is listening to this program right now and has a loved one in the hospital, whether for a happy reason like the birth of a child or somebody who has a cancer or another serious diagnosis, what are the guidelines about whether or not it's a good idea to visit that person?
Well, we put into place some difficult decisions around how and who should be visiting, when, what times, and what under what circumstances. So, and we looked at it mostly from the standpoint of if this was our loved one in the hospital, what would we want to make sure we absolutely allowed? So, for example, at our hospitals, patients who pediatric patients or those with a guardian, they are allowed one visitor. If you are a laboring mom, you're allowed a birth partner. If your family member is critically ill, you are allowed one visitor. What we tried to do in making our restrictions is to think about it from the standpoint of having the support necessary for those people who absolutely need it, but then also using, like we talked about earlier, using technology to facilitate the conversations that loved ones can have if you're recovering from an operation, making sure that the phone's available to them, that if they need to have any kind of video equipment, that's available. So we've tried to make it so that the patients get the support that they need, because having support from family and friends is so important, while balancing the needs to ensure that we limit the number of people that are in our hospital, especially people who are out in the community and then coming in here. Our number one goal has continued to be keeping our staff safe and keeping our patients safe.
All right. Well, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about the medical repercussions from the COVID-19 crisis. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Coastal Transitions, a local company committed to helping seniors find their best living option. Learn more at coastaltransitionsofmaine.com. And Evergreen Subaru in Auburn, Maine, committed to going the extra mile for its customers, its team, and its community. EvergreenSubaru.com.
Defense attorneys are sounding the alarm about a group that's particularly vulnerable to the coronavirus, people in jail.
Once coronavirus gets into a jail, there's no way to stop it from spreading. You cannot do social distancing in a jail.
Some states are reducing bail and releasing people considered nonviolent, balancing justice and safety in a pandemic. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. With coronavirus, physical distancing practices now in place all around our state, you may find that you have young ones around the house more than usual. Might we suggest a couple of valued educational resources that will make their time worthwhile? Maine Public's PBS Kids 24/7 is a free over-the-air television channel that is a wonderful learning environment with trusted educational non-commercial programming for those younger folks. And PBS Learning Media is a free online educational K-12 learning resource with material and lessons for children and young adults of all ages. You'll find PBS Learning Media at mainepublic.org. Please click on the education drop-down and enjoy.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about healthcare that is not coronavirus related, from medical issues to mental health treatment to dental care. My guests are Dr. John Alexander, who is Chief Medical Officer with Central Maine Healthcare, and Dr. Steve Stout, Medical Director of Ambulatory Services for Maine Behavioral Healthcare. After this segment, we will go to a live briefing with Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah and Governor Mills. And following that briefing, Maine Calling will resume with a discussion focused on dealing with anxiety. We will be extended until 4 o'clock today. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now, Dr. Brad Rand. He is president of the Maine Dental Association. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Rand.
Good afternoon.
Is there a statewide policy for what dental offices are doing at this time?
There is. We've received a recommendation from the governor asking us to, as others have mentioned, to limit all non-essential services. But also, we've been asked to actively try to help divert people from the emergency rooms if they are having a dental emergency.
I'm going to read to you an email we got from Paula. She writes, "What if someone has a dental emergency and the dentist is closed?"
It's a great question. I would ask her to call her dentist's office. They likely will have an emergency number, so that may require listening to more than just the first part of the message where they say that they are closed for routine dentistry. Many dental offices will have a number that you can call to get in touch with the dentist to make sure that if you do have a dental emergency, you are seen in the office.
What kinds of procedures or problems are something that would be an important enough emergency to call your dentist now and not wait until this subsides?
So the guidelines for that would be, are you having pain or swelling or bleeding that you can't get to stop, or if you're having some sort of dental trauma?
Are you wondering what the biggest problems your centers are facing, as well as the families? What is happening so far?
I think in the dental world, there has been that shift to trying to find out how we can best serve the community with these types of emergencies. We have heard from hospitals that they're grateful that the dentists are seeing patients, that we are trying to keep these infections and pain out of the emergency room for a number of reasons. One of them is to preserve those precious spaces in the emergency room for those who truly need it now. So I think as in dentistry, I'm proud of our dentists for being able to really ramp up and try to do this new type of dentistry in the current situation that we have.
All right. Before I let you go, another email just came in, and I'm going to read this to you. This is from Lucia. A week ago today, I was at my oral surgeon's office to have a tooth extracted when I was told they just received orders to shut down the practice because of COVID-19. My tooth was badly decayed but not hurting at the time. I was given a prescription for antibiotics in case it started to be painful. When I got home, I called my dentist and was told they were closing and any dental issues should be addressed at the emergency department. Is this, and what is, still the proper procedure? That was 1 week ago that she was given that advice.
Yeah, and I think that, as I mentioned before, I think we need to make the distinction between closed and closed for routine services. And we're trying actively as an organization now. 90% of the dentists in Maine are members of the Maine Dental Association, so there are some who are not. In addition, I have been trying to almost daily send out communication to our members to try to make this distinction, that we're not closed, we're closed for routine services, but that we need to make sure that we have an availability to see these types of patients now. If that procedure doesn't fall under one of those things I mentioned before, pain, infection, trauma, bleeding, it may be something that can be postponed, but if it's not, we certainly want to take care of it now.
All right. Well, Dr. Rand, we're going to ask you if you'd mind staying on the line for a while in case you can answer some more questions from our listeners. I really appreciate it. And I am going to go now to an email from Beth, which I think is going to be for Dr. Alexander. She writes, I have seen a post asking people to sew masks. Are cloth masks effective and needed? And Dr. Alexander, this is all over my social media feed. People madly sewing masks, trying to be of some help during this crisis.
So it's also all over our social media feeds, both internally and to those of us with our personal emails as well. You know, the challenge with cloth masks, and you'll find there's no one right answer to this, but the challenge with cloth masks is that in many cases, if not most cases, they're not going to provide the necessary protection that a healthcare provider would need, especially in the setting of a patient who is either suspected of or has COVID-19. They are, however, you know, can be useful for more routine usage, and, you know, as the situation continues to develop, and like we talked about at the outset, that will probably continue to change week by week, we may end up determining that cloth masks may have a role. What we've done is we've had our infection prevention experts take a look at some different designs and patterns, specifically the designs in terms of how the cloth is overlaid, what the cloth material is made of. So there's actually quite a lot that goes into the thought process behind it. And we're trying to provide some guidance to those who have volunteered to create some masks so that if there is the opportunity for them to be helpful in that regard, they can. But in general, right now, we have the supplies we need. There's always going to be some limitations on those supplies. The federal government and the state emergency management agency continue to release resources to us. But we are very thankful for all of the people who have asked about creating, sewing for us or doing some other things.
And Dr. Rand, let me ask you about the medical masks. I know the dentists have a lot of masks. Are there enough to give some to the hospitals or other dental supplies that could be useful?
We've been talking about that this week, actually. If you think about in dentistry, if you go, for example, you go get an eye exam, generally that person isn't wearing a mask. But when you go to a dental office, your hygienist, your dentist, and your assistant are all wearing a mask every time you go to our office. And so there are dentists that do have excess masks. In fact, they've become increasingly more difficult to find. We've heard many, many stories of grassroots efforts on the part of our members to give away masks to first responders, hospitals, clinics, nursing homes. We are organizing as a dental association to try to help distribute these masks in an organized way. I gave 350 away yesterday to a smaller satellite hospital. So there are some resources that dentists have, and I feel like they've been really generous.
All right. We'll go to Mallory. Hi, Mallory. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Mallory Shaughnessy, and I am the Executive Director of the Alliance for Addiction and Mental Health Services of Maine. We are the statewide association of sort of safety net providers for these services. And I just was following up to some comments and discussion when Jenna Maynard with NAMI Maine was on the line earlier. I just want to share that we have some real concerns about those most vulnerable amongst us that are struggling with addiction and mental health challenges, and also that these safety net providers are able to stay open and functioning and meeting their needs as we move forward. I know there's been some stories in the news around closures and reduced access to various community-based services with the stagnant reimbursement rates through MaineCare. Many of these agencies are already hanging on a thread to try to keep these services available. And with this kind of disruption in service, we're seeing already hundreds of staff being laid off and trying to transition to the telephonic and televideo services, but a real need for some kind of a relief package specific to this safety net, especially at this time.
All right. And Dr. Stout, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, I agree with Mallory that this is a it's been a chronic issue for us in behavioral health care, even prior to the COVID concerns, that we've really been having trouble in terms of staying in the black to provide services, particularly community-based services. And so the particular challenges associated with our current pandemic make that considerably worse. As you might imagine, it's very difficult to keep operations running as smoothly and efficiently and as cost effectively under these circumstances as it was prior to this time. And so it's going to be a real area of concern over the next few weeks and months. Fortunately, we're in a position in Maine Behavioral Health Care as being a member organization of Maine Health, and we are really, continuing to pledge to maintain our services and provide as much support to the community as we can.
Mallory, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that perspective. We're going to go to Limerick and Margaret. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. Yes, I would just wonder if anybody else has thought of this. The neti pot, which is a nasal and throat irrigation system that's very easy to use, and at the first tinge or hint of irritation in your nostril, use the neti pot. I have stopped many a cold from going further if I'm not lazy about it, and I use it right away, and it just might be worth a try.
Margaret, thanks for your call. Dr. Alexander?
Sure. So, I think any of the symptom relief that people use at home, they should continue to go ahead and use. And I'm very familiar with the neti pot. Many of my aunts and uncles still have them in their homes as well. So, but the important part about if you're going to use something like a neti pot or an inhaler or nasal spray, the important part is to make sure that it's really being used by one individual, that it shouldn't be shared amongst family members, and that it gets cleaned, in between uses. But absolutely, if it provides symptomatic relief, I'm all for it.
Margaret, thanks for your call. If you would like to join the conversation, if you have questions about your medical care during this time or about someone you love, give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email, a brief email, please, and do it quickly, to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom, uma.edu, and Black Cow Burgers and Fries on Exchange Street in Portland, offering delivery and curbside takeout service by phone or online and at blackcowburgers.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On March 20, 1852, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin was published as a novel. Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin while living in Brunswick in 1851. The novel is credited with helping to spur on abolitionists and is cited among the causes of the American Civil War. The book sold 10,000 copies in its first week. Stowe was also a strong advocate of women's rights, religious tolerance, and educational reform. Stowe died in 1896.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine!
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Pollan, who's written best-selling books about the origins of the food we eat and how psychedelics are helping scientists understand consciousness and the brain. He has a new audiobook about caffeine, its effect on the mind and body. As usual, he immersed himself in his research, quitting coffee cold turkey. Join us.
And Fresh Air is this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, in this part of our program, we are talking about how health care is being handled now in Maine, from mental health treatment to dental care to hospital visits. Joining us, Dr. Brad Rand with the Maine Dental Association, Dr. Steve Stout with Maine Behavioral Health Care, and Dr. John Alexander with Central Maine Health Care. After this, there will be a live broadcast of Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah and Governor Mills. Following that, we will return to Maine Calling, and our topic after the news conference will be dealing with anxiety. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go now to a voicemail that came in before the program. This is from Jeannie in Saco.
My question is this. My son has cancer and needs regular chemotherapy treatments at a clinic in Scarborough. Are we in any danger of those clinics being closed or the chemotherapy drugs not being available? Thank you so much.
Dr. Alexander.
Absolutely not. So these are the types of procedures and treatments that we've been making sure that we can maintain for our communities. We have ensured that our infusion centers and our oncology services are all continue to be up and running so that patients who are referred who have the concern of cancer and might need diagnostic procedures performed to those who have been diagnosed and need treatment, that those treatments stay in place. What we have done specifically as it relates to cancer treatment is for those patients who perhaps have gone through their treatments and are in remission, is we've gone to each of our providers and looked at their patients and the scheduled visits and asked them the question as to which visits can be postponed and which visits can't. And because the providers know their patients so well, they're able to have those conversations with the patients and then give them the guidance that they need in terms of if X happens, here's what you should do. So, but in terms of receiving active cancer treatments, to the best of my knowledge, none of the systems in the state have done anything other than make sure that the environment where those patients are receiving treatments are safe, that they have their infection precautions fully in place.
All right, here's a message from Joseph. If your doctor wrote you an order to get blood drawn for something that's not urgent but still important, should you get it done or wait? Is there any reason to get lab work done at this time?
So I think that's going to be an individual decision, but it's also it depends on what the circumstance is. And that also falls into the area where a lot of our providers, and I suspect Dr. Stout would say the same thing from the mental health arena as well, that's where a lot of our providers are using telehealth as a platform so that they can identify what needs to happen for patients remotely. They can make contact with them over the phone or if it's available through video conferencing. There are some people who need to have blood taken on a regular basis because of medication monitoring or other conditions, and so that discussion should happen with their provider.
All right, Dr. Stout, anything you'd like to add to that?
I would agree with Dr. Alexander that if there are questions about lab monitoring or any other procedure that you may be scheduled for, to call your provider to ask. We certainly are at Maine Behavioral Healthcare doing the same thing where we're prioritizing the more important tests and really trying to postpone anything that isn't essential right now. But your provider, your office would be able to give you a good answer about that.
All right. We're going to go to Kath, who's calling from Yarmouth. Hi, Kath. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. My question is simple. If someone already has health issues that put them in the risk group, are they more likely to get the virus, or are they just more likely to get sicker if they get the virus?
Great question. Dr. Alexander, do you know the answer?
Well, we don't know the answer with 100% certainty, but we believe that you're more likely to that people who have multiple comorbid conditions or multiple serious illnesses, that when or if they get the virus will could have more serious health consequences, but that those conditions don't themselves predispose people to contacting the virus.
All right, Kath, thanks so much for your question. We're going to go to Stephanie, who's calling from Palmyra. Hi, Stephanie, go ahead.
Oh, hello. Hi, my question is about, and first I want to say I fully support that we have to ration certain healthcare and put emergency procedures in place now. But I'm wondering how they come up with the metric or if the protocols are pre-established on what gets delayed and what doesn't. A specific example I have is in my healthcare system, Mohs surgeries for melanoma are going forward. But say invasive squamous cell, fast growing, is delayed for at least 2 months. So are these federally established guidelines or are they kind of being made by each health organization on their own?
Dr. Alexander.
Sure. There aren't really any specific guidelines that have been put out in terms of which specifically under which conditions, which procedures should be postponed. There are some general ones. So we looked at, for example, screening colonoscopies. Screening colonoscopies are something that has been decided, I think, more or less universally, certainly across our state and even across the country, is an area where we don't need to perform those right now. They can be postponed. But because so much of the medical decision-making between a provider and the patient has to do with some other individualized characteristics, what are the other conditions that you're dealing with? What is the staging, for example? What is the staging of a particular skin disorder? What's your transportation? Some other things like that. Those are the discussions and the decisions that happen at the provider level. The best thing that we've identified that we're able to do right now is to be proactive about that so that we can give our patients the information ahead of time rather than trying to perform these cancellations or postponements, either the day of or the day before, so we can have a discussion.
All right. Thank you, Stephanie, for your call. Dr. Stout, anything you wanted to add to that?
I would agree with Dr. Alexander. I have nothing more to add.
Okay, great. I want to go to an email from Rob. He's asking about elective surgery, and he's, I think, talking about when they will, healthcare facilities, hospitals will offer elective surgery again. He says, will that be done on a statewide basis or by county? My knee surgeon is in a county with a few cases. Could they reopen sooner than in Cumberland County?
Yeah, I don't think it's possible to know that answer. It's not likely going to happen county by county. You know, what we've been trying to do is we've been trying to follow the guidance of the Maine CDC. And although what we've seen is we've seen county reports and an understanding of where there's community spread, when that community spread goes from moderate to widespread, we also recognize that because, and this is true, again, across the, not only across the country, but across the globe, that the testing that we're doing is being used on high-risk individuals. That does not mean that there is not a prevalence of coronavirus in mildly symptomatic people. We're just not fundamentally testing those mildly symptomatic people. We're assuming that if you have some symptoms, that you need to stay home. If you're healthy enough to stay home, then you should stay home. If you're not, and we've set out those guidelines, then we want to make sure that you're being assessed and tested. But what all that means as it relates to then restarting elective procedures has to do with the idea that we want to make sure that we've contained the virus as best as we can so that all of our patients and our communities can feel safe to access the type of elective procedures that are necessary.
We have an email here from Sunny who writes, we live in an area with dozens of families with only one internet provider, satellite, that costs $150 to $300 a month without enough bandwidth for video. Cell phones don't work here. The signal's too weak to even text, despite a nearby tower. Our health insurance providers can't understand that there could be a place in the U.S. without enough internet for video to work, so no doctor's appointments allowed without internet that can do video. We've begged the cell providers to boost the signal and the DSL provider in the past to expand the lines, but they won't even return our calls despite the dozens of families and businesses that would sign up. Lack of internet access in parts of Maine isn't about access to Netflix. It's for us about access to critical medical care. You know, we've spent a good deal of this program talking about televideo, telehealth. And I'm wondering, Dr. Alexander, I know that there have been some limitations in the past to phone conversations and what insurance companies will reimburse for. Is that changing during this crisis?
It has changed, and I suspect both Dr. Stout and perhaps Dr. Rand also have seen that change as well from their perspective, but it has changed. So one of the primary ways that we are reaching to our patients is through phone services, and the way the federal government has restructured and put into effect some emergency actions allows reimbursement to some extent for that work. So it is the way that we found it to be very effective, and it's a lot easier, I think, when you have an established relationship with a provider. So I don't certainly want to diminish the importance of having the ability to have some sort of video contact, but right now it's one of the most effective ways that we can maintain the health of our patients, while also, you know, using the distancing that's necessary to help prevent spread of the virus.
All right. And Dr. Rand, are you doing any consultations or your members doing consultations by telephone right now?
I think I want to make the distinction between teledentistry and then phone conferencing. So we certainly are doing phone conferencing. That would be screening a patient, asking questions, making sure that somebody that needs to be seen in the office. Unfortunately, teledentistry as a name is not currently authorized under the Maine Dental Practice Act. There is actually pending legislation that was in the legislature that was unfortunately cut short, and I was on the ad hoc committee where we discussed and defined teledentistry. We just don't have it quite yet.
All right, and Dr. Stout.
As Dr. Alexander was mentioning earlier, the federal government has made it considerably easier for us to use the telephone as well as televideo. And so that's what we're doing. And as I mentioned earlier in the hour, as of last week, we have been seeing about 85% of our patients by phone. And I also agree with Dr. Alexander that it's a lot easier if one is already familiar with a particular patient and the patient is familiar with their provider. That relationship has already been established. It's easier to maintain the relationship than it is to start a new relationship, and that's where we are really hoping that televideo will be quite helpful. And then there will still be those occasional instances where we will want to see people in person and coming up with a plan and procedures to make sure that's as safe as possible will be really important.
An email from Diane, is it safe to go to a blood donation event to give blood? What precautions should I take? Dr. Alexander, I know this is very important for yours and other hospitals.
It is, and we have been encouraging our employees as well as patients in our community to continue to give blood. The blood donor locations also recognize the importance of good infection control practices, good hygiene. And so although I can't speak to all of the blood donor sites, the ones that we've listed out and we've posted those to make those available for both our staff and our public on our websites, and I would feel confident that the other health systems and hospitals have done the same, those are the ones that certainly people should feel confident being able to go to and provide that service.
All right. And, you know, we just have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to give a little bit of time to each of you to, if you could talk to all of your patients right now, all at once. Dr. Rand, what would you tell them?
Well, I think we have in Maine, we have great patients. They've been very patient with us. They understand. They know that we're trying to protect them. They know that we're trying to protect our staff. We're trying to keep people from being around each other. I know that's been a common theme that everyone's talked about. And we're trying to help keep people out of the ER. If you do have something that you need to be seen for, call your dentist. We want to talk to you. We want to see you. We want to make sure that we can keep you out of those places where you're more likely to contact somebody else who has the virus. So be safe. Keep brushing. Keep flossing. Keep smiling.
All right. And Dr. Stout, I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds of the show.
Sure. Thank you. So I would say to our patients and our people of Maine who are not our patients that mental illness and addiction is essentially a disease of isolation and loneliness, and that in this time that one doesn't need to feel alone, that there are still resources out there to talk with and to be helpful. So please feel free to reach out.
All right. Well, that is going to have to be the last word. I appreciate all three of you giving us your time today on Maine Calling. This was, you just heard Dr. Steve Stout with Maine Behavioral Healthcare. Also with us for the hour, Dr. John Alexander with Central Maine Healthcare. Also with us, Dr. Brad Rand with the Maine Dental Association. Stay with us to hear what Dr. Nirev Shah of the Maine CDC and Governor Janet Mills will be announcing live next on Maine Public Radio. And we will continue with our second part of Maine Calling after that briefing. Our topic is dealing with anxiety in these uncertain times. Lucy Suchek is running the board for this. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. The Maine CDC briefing is next.